This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Marcus Brunzi here. Before we start today's podcast, I'd just like to let you know that you can vote for us in the Listener's Choice Awards at this year's British Podcast Awards 2019. If you'd like to vote for us, it only takes a minute of your time. Head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. That's britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Type in How to Kill an Hour and then, yeah, you'll have voted for us. It only takes a minute of your time and we'd really appreciate it. We'll also put a link in the show's description. Thank you very much in advance. And hey, here's hoping we win. Anyway, over to the podcast.
Are you serious?
So this is How to Kill an Hour. My name is Marcus Bronzy. There's plenty of ways to kill some time out there. Thank you in advance for killing some time with us. Today, I'm going to be joined by a group of people that have put together an amazing horror film called The Risen Possession. And they're going to be hopping on in just a moment. But first things first, I'd like to introduce Stefan Powell to the studio today. Welcome here, man. Welcome.
Thanks
to
for having
hour.
Me. Yeah, great.
Great to have you in the building. You are a broadcaster who covers a real range of things like at the moment. We will get into it, but is it fair to say that in your job you cover a wide range of subjects?
Yes, it's a busy time at the moment. So I work for Newsbeat on BBC Radio 1, and in that job it means that one minute you could be talking about Brexit, the next minute I'm talking about Nintendo Labo, and in between a bit of sport. You know, it changes, the news changes, the stuff we cover, you know, is really varied, which means every day is different, but sometimes you don't know what's happening, and trying to turn on your gaming brain, turn off your politics brain, it is what it is.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, how do you switch between subjects? Do you need like 5 minutes in a room?
You have a word with yourself.
Yeah, just have a chat with yourself.
Look in the mirror.
Not Brexit, Nintendo,
What hat am I wearing today? But to be fair, I'm lucky in sense of a lot of the stuff we cover. I've always been a guy that loves the news and interested in the news and wanted to know how it affects me, my mates, my family, whatever. So I've always been interested in it, and it doesn't, you know, we're just talking about stuff that I find fascinating. And so it doesn't really matter whether it's politics or gaming. I like that stuff. I like talking about it. So it doesn't, you know, I've been quite lucky in that sense. Sometimes if you get a story this a bit dry, I'm not going to lie, it's going to happen, I won't name names, but you know, some stories aren't the most exciting things and they sort of happen fairly regularly. You're a bit like, okay, how am I going to make this interesting? But then that's a challenge, because you're like, well, if I find this story boring, how can I make it exciting so that I might want to listen to it? And then hopefully someone at home will want to listen as well in the same way.
I think that's the difference with the Newsbeat stuff as well, is that you kind of do pump energy into it that kind of makes it relevant. And also, like you said, some topics out there are real dry, but it's good to be informed about them. So.
Yeah, you've got to know, I mean, this stuff, I mean, you know, people would say that about Brexit, for example, sometimes, but it's really important stuff that's going to really sort of impact people's lives. Yeah. So you've got to try and make it as exciting and as different as you can.
But Brexit gets you going though, isn't it? I've seen Stefan a couple of times out and about over the last few weeks, and I'll be like, how's the Brexit situation? He goes, oh man, so much hour by hour, minute by minute, things are changing.
And I'm not even, I do politics off and on in the office. Our politics guy, Jim, he's living and breathing it. Can't sleep because he's getting updates on his phone.
Crazy.
And it's all going to change. It could, you know, by the time I come out of this studio, things would have changed again. It's quite crazy.
Who knows what will happen, mate? It's crazy.
But I do other stuff to kill an hour. We're not here to talk about that exclusively today.
How have you been killing time out outside of work? And because you like you're a busy guy, as I'm sure it's quite apparent right now. What have you been doing to chill out?
I'll tell you what I've been doing this week is I've been doing something that I promised myself around Christmas time I would do. And that is, and I'm a bit ashamed to say this, to be honest with you, but I feel like we can share stuff together.
Yeah, man, go for it.
I'm finishing Red Dead Redemption 2 because I didn't finish it.
I still ain't finished it.
Big, Billy, producer Billy's like, still ain't finished it.
Yeah, it's big.
It's a big ass game.
It's so big. Now, it's you know, it's fantastic, but it's really big. Now, there is an argument to be had as to whether or not games are getting too big. And that's an interesting debate. One of my other favourite games was a game called The Witcher 3, yeah. similar to open world, same type of thing, but with sort of, you know, monsters and soldiers rather than cowboys and Indians. And that was about 100 hours or whatever to finish it. And towards the end of that, I was rushing it so much so that I ended up getting the bad ending.
Yeah.
Because,
right.
you know, there's some decisions that you make and then it impacts what happens. And I've ended up and I've all that time and you know, the thing that I won't spoiler alert, you know, happens. Yeah. So I'm determined that that's not going to happen in Red Dead. I want to take my time over the story, but it has taken ages. And there's been a chunk in the middle where I didn't, you know, didn't touch it for a couple of weeks.
Right. And what was it like stepping back into that world? Because it's people forget how slow Red Dead Redemption is, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but the pace of it. Like, I came into Red Dead off the back of playing some Spider-Man. Spider-Man is like you're zinging around the city, throwing web shoots everywhere. You can literally traverse, you know, New York City in like minutes, right? And then Red Dead, you're in camp, and then you like take a fast stroll over to your horse. Trot to another village, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
things get a bit spicy, it's a slow, the pace of it is real slow as
so
well.
This is something I chatted about on Newsbeat once, in saying, when you think of Rockstar, you think of Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, man.
If I want to get from point A to point B in the GTA version of LA,
yeah, man,
I get in a supercar.
Yeah.
I'm there in 30 seconds.
Exactly.
But in Red Dead, I'm on my horse.
Super horse.
You know, and as I'm, you know, I'm riding my horse really hard because I'm trying to mainline the story at the moment. I'm trying to get to the end. I want to know what happens to Arthur Morgan. It's got to a point now where things are getting a bit spicy and things are starting to go a bit south. And I want to know what happens. And so I feel like almost the experience is passing me by. Which is a shame. So, because what sometimes, you know, some people do is they finish the main story and then they go back and experience the world and sit in it for a while and go and, you know, help some randomers on the street or rob some banks or whatever. So that's what I'm doing at the moment, is I want to finish it so I can, because I interviewed Roger Clark recently, the guy who plays Arthur Morgan, on the red carpet at the BAFTAs, right? And I'm like, I've got so much, you know, respect for his performance. I love his character. And in my head, that's all I'm thinking is, I haven't finished the game. I'm such a fraud. I haven't finished the game. But I've done, you know, I've done a good chunk. I've done the three quarters of it. So that's what I'm trying to do at the moment. And I'm enjoying it. I'm finding myself, right, I'm going to do an hour tonight. Next thing you know, it's midnight.
Yeah, man.
And the wife's like, are you coming to bed or what? I was like, well, I've still got this thing you still have to do.
Yeah, but maybe I've got to clean my guns, then I've got to go handle some business over the other side of the map. Do you know what I mean? It's hard life out here.
It is stuff to do.
But it's an interesting point you said about games being too big. I mean, like, it is, I feel that's a good conversation to be having in the world where you can get bumped when you get certain games and apps. It can be like a day or two experience. But with Rockstar, I feel like, one, it couldn't be anything other than a massive game, because otherwise I feel like we'd be like, that's not the full Rockstar treatment.
Yeah.
And two, how can a story like that be cut down and be any shorter? It's an epic story.
Yeah, and that's the challenge, and that's the sort of the emotion I'm going through, is I'm loving every second of it.
Yeah.
But I also desperately want a resolution.
You need to live a normal life as well, in the real world.
Exactly. And so is that balance, I guess, between telling a story without sort of, you know, and I know, you know, games is big, you can have experiences that you finish in 30 minutes, and games you finish, you know, that take years. But it's just because a game can be massive now, should it be? And is there another way of doing that experience in a way that gives you the choice as to whether you want to spend 150 hours on the story or 30, whatever it might be?
Good point. I mean, so are you running through the world now, and kind of when people call out to you like, hey man, can you help me? You're like, sorry mate, got a mission to do. Is that what you're like now?
I have left so many people stranded calling for help.
People stuck under horses,
you know,
crippled.
People getting robbed on the side of the street, and like, I'd love to help you. Because you know that little bar on the bottom on Red Dead Redemption 2 that says how good you are?
Yeah.
Well, for some reason, I was like, no, I'm going to be really good. So mine was towards the top end of, like, you know, why? And then, well, the last couple of nights, I've just been playing it to try and finish, and it is sliding down. The amount of people I could have saved and I've left hanging, it's, you know, it's going really down badly. But I just want to get to the end.
You'll get there, man. It's well worth it. I don't say this without spoiling.
I think you'll be very careful, because the ending of the first one is one of my favourite moments in all of games. I got to shed a tear. You know, without giving it away, there's a moment using the Deadeye in a barn.
Yeah, the kind of, it's oh, I don't know, but
it's the thing, right?
It's the moment where you feel like you want the main protagonist really to win like no other part in the game, right? Yeah, you really want him to win.
Yeah. And so, and it's one of my favourite moments ever. I wrote an article about it once, how that clever moment changed my perception of gaming, and you know, I shed a tear, right? So I'm not expecting anything like that, but I want to go into it with my eyes closed. Avoiding spoilers online has been a real tricky thing to do.
Yeah, it's a hard one. All right, Red Dead Redemption, like that. Well, I've been killing time with some high tech pajamas. I mentioned this to Stefan.
So what?
Yeah.
Sorry, you just run that past me again.
Some high tech pajamas. Basically, a group of people. I want to make sure I pronounce this right. It's Dags Mejan, right? They sent us some pajamas, and they were like, "These are going to help you sleep better." And we do get sent stuff here at How to Kill an Hour. And sometimes I'm like, "Oh, that sounds cool." Sometimes I'm like, "Really?" And I'll be honest, I'm not really a pajamas guy. I'm more of a commando guy. I like to have a shower.
I feel like I'm getting to know you really well, you mate.
Oh, by the end of this episode, you're going to know so much, Stefan. But I'm a commando guy. Like I'm have a quick shower and then I'll hop into bed and that's it. I'm good. So I was like, pajamas, are they really necessary? So I thought maybe in, you know, this mature time in my life, it was something that I should try, especially because there are a couple of pairs that just been sent to us.
Yeah.
So basically, these pajamas are apparently made from the world's most natural fibers, and they've got sleep technology in them, right? So it's this stuff called merino wool, right? And apparently in them, this is all the stuff I was reading, you could sleep for 15 minutes longer at least every single night. And, you know, if you add that up over a year, that's hours and days of sleep and whatever. And long story short, they were really comfortable pajamas, right? So I remember putting these on and thinking, oh, I felt like bedtime was a bit of an event now, yeah? And one, they were comfortable. And I don't know whether this was like an effect that was, I don't know, whether it was a placebo, but I did feel like I did get a good night's sleep. And I feel like putting on my pajamas is a bit of an event now. When I pop them on and sit down and chill out, they do a bit of work for me. But how, like, are you, like, I need to get behind this. I was going to ask Billy, but I'd like to ask you, like, are you a pajama wearer or not? Like, or do you just wear like a t-shirt and some shorts or whatever?
It depends entirely on the time of year. So like winter, it's a bit nippy out.
Okay.
It's a bit cold.
Yeah.
I'm up for a pajama.
Okay.
Summer, no chance.
All right. So summer, you like more like a t-shirt?
Yeah, summer I can go commando if I fancy it. I mean, I haven't got a routine.
Okay.
But what I'm interested with your setup is yours. Did you have a good night's sleep because you'd never worn a pajama before? So could it have been any pair of pajamas, or do you think it was this special jazzy pajama?
I've worn like shorts and a t-shirt before, like just a pair of like.
That's solid. And that's why I say that's my. If you added it up over a year, I'd say I'm usually a short and t-shirt kind of guy.
Yeah, no, but I just felt like making bedtime a bit of an event, slipping into something more comfortable. It worked for me, and yeah, like the fact that these were like, they weren't just like a baggy pair of shorts or trousers, because I actually got a pair that were like summery ones and wintery ones. The fact that they were quite like smooth and silky when you put them on, like it does make a difference sliding into something kind of silky and smooth. So like, I'd like to say I now, Marcus Bronzy, I've graduated to wearing pajamas the majority of the time.
You've become a man.
I have. Pipe and slippers next.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on it. So at the moment, this time of year, it's like spring. So are you like in the shorts now?
Shorts are on now. Yeah, the long sleeve has sort of been banished to the wardrobe, and now we're on into the shorts territory. Yeah.
And what about the wife as well? Is she like a hot wife or a cold wife?
At the moment, we've got the window open. All right. And it is so freezing cold. So my wife's also works in news. She's a breakfast news reader.
All right.
So every day she's up at 4:30 a.m. to go to work to read the news, right?
Yeah.
So she's obviously in bed, fast asleep by the time I get in there. But the window's open. It's like a fridge in there. It's like, come on. So yeah, no, she's quite a hot person in the night.
All right, cool. So you'd benefit from the dogs, Mejan.
You would get the biggest bed you can and sleep as far away from each other as physically possible. I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, and get as much sheets as possible as well. Is she a sheet stealer? Or
I have a reputation for being the sheet stealer,
right.
Which I think is totally unfounded, by the way. I just think, you know, sometimes they just find anything to have a go at you for. You know, and so that's
hey,
what it is.
Hey,
so.
Miss Powell's listening. I don't know what to say. But yeah, what I have been doing when I've been getting into bed, and you kind of said it was a bit of like a guilty Well, I don't know. It was not finishing Red Dead, something to be good about. It's an enormous game, but something I've been actually getting into is a really old series. So listeners of the show know that I've been watching Star Trek from the actual beginning, right? So
wow, I've been working. That's some undertaking.
Oh, bruv, it's a fun challenge, but I didn't realize it was that big.
How many episodes is that? There must be like hundreds of them.
Oh, quite literally. So there were like three or four seasons of the original series. Then there's a series, an animated series people don't know about, which actually had all the voices of the original characters.
That's niche.
Then now I've just finished The Next Generation like last night, and there's seven seasons, 20 plus episodes each. About an hour run to about 50 minutes when you take out
it's the like a day job.
Brother, I've been churning through them, and I actually felt quite emotional watching Captain Picard kind of finishing off the last episode. It's like an hour and a half episode, but I've been going through it, and I'm about to hit the Star Trek films now. So if you'd watch it in the right order, there's a few Star Trek films you watch after the original series.
Yeah.
And then there's some ones that kind of blend into the Next Generation. So yeah, that's what I've been churning my way through, man.
So I love sci-fi, right? Yeah. Big fan of sci-fi, but I've always found Star Trek wasn't a natural home for me for some reason. I found some of the sort of sci-fi language a bit, the wibbly wobbly, you know, the parsecs, the nuclear, you know, all that stuff, a bit too much. I think sometimes I felt like it was trying too hard. But then, you know, I know the Star Trek fans absolutely love it and they get totally into it. I did really enjoy the reboot with Chris Pine. Yeah. That stuff's been really fun. But I'm not sure, as much as I love sci-fi, if I've got it in me to do what you've done. I watched the new series as well when I was on a flight once, and I watched a couple of episodes on, and I watched that.
Which new series? Because for me, new series is going to be Deep Space Nine.
1998, yeah. What's the really most recent one?
Is it Enterprise? It's the one on Netflix, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got the actress from Walking Dead in it.
Discovery.
So I've watched a few episodes of Discovery when I was on a flight once, and really enjoying it, and really enjoyed it. And so, and I can remember being on Radio 1 that we had his name escapes me, Lucius Malfoy.
Oh, I can't remember.
Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs,
the actor.
Yeah,
he's also in it, and he came in to talk to us about it, and I watched a few episodes of that and thought it was great. So there's bits of Star Trek I really like, but I don't know. There was something about the original stuff that alienated me, and I don't know why.
You know, it is heavy. Like, they do throw a lot of contradictory kind of science terminology in there. I think actually, you're going to find out how much of a nerd I am. There's actually bits in the script where they just write tech. They just write, so Geordi, he was a guy that was in the engine room, they write, Geordi has a problem with tech, and then some geezer would come in and just write, like, you know, dilithium crystal crack. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
so there's one guy in there that had to kind of make it sound right, but I reckon they did cut a few corners. But I think what I love about Star Trek The Next Generation is the fact that it's kind of like, it's trying to show them the best side of the human race in the future. Like, if things go right and we make some right decisions and we try to be good people, this is where we can be. Equal rights in ways that are just unheard of today. Do you know what I mean?
It's quite aspirational in that sense as a human. If you take all the, you know, the rest of it out there, it is people trying to better themselves and better people around them.
Yeah, yeah.
And being quite selfless as well.
Yeah.
Because these days, a lot of drama and TV and movies or whatever, there's always a conflicted central character, isn't there? Who's usually, like, there's you know, the couple of tropes out there. The drunk detective, you know, or the guy who's not faithful to his wife but is also saving the murder mystery.
Yeah.
You know, there's the guy, you know, in Game of Thrones, only a handful of characters are truly good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there's something about Star Trek that's quite innocent, isn't it? It's quite, I know who I'm rooting for. Yeah. I know why I'm rooting for them, and that's just great.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just really matter of fact with some of its progressive output. So, like, when I was watching the original series, I forget that this is a show that's like 55 years old, right? And you've got like a black woman, like, with a main role in this show. Like, so a woman to be a part of the main cast without just silly dilly-dally lines, dressed up like a cheerleader.
Yeah.
At that time was phenomenal. So you've got Uhura there, and you've got Sulu there on the comms, and then you've got other alien life forms, and they're all just living together, working together for this greater purpose. And it was just, it's an inspirational watch when you take it from that point of view. And even when you look at things like Voyager, you've got a female captain. It's just so matter of fact. It's not, they don't make a thing about it. Do you know what I mean? And it's like in a world now where everybody wants to have equal rights, rightly so, and everyone wants to kind of just pull together and move forward, rightly so. Again, it's nice to kind of watch a show like that, you know, especially where there's so much going on in the world, to kind of flick over to Star Trek. It's kind of like, oh, that's nice. It's a nice little refreshing break from the world.
So my eyes just caught in the corner. You've got a PlayStation VR headset.
Yeah, man, that's it.
Have you played the Star Trek?
Of course I fucking have. Yeah, of course I have.
Because if you're into your Star Trek, that's class. That's when I first played that, is when I truly thought for the first time, I can kind of see this VR thing working. Because up until that point, I was like, I don't get it. Yeah. Gaming is these days all about sort of bringing people together, and VR sort of isolates you from that. But this game, you know, we basically, if you haven't played it, you take controls of different parts of the ship, and you've got a captain who's in charge, and someone's in charge of shooting, someone's in charge of driving or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't drive a spaceship, do you? Whatever. Right, you know what I mean?
That's all right.
I would roll with that. Yeah. And that, when I played that with a couple of people a few years ago at an E3, I was like, oh, right, this is what it can be.
Yeah.
This can bring people together. I thought that was really cool.
Showed a cool co-op side of VR, man. In case you didn't notice, Stefan is part of the gaming show on Radio 1. Like, you know, so you are into gaming quite a lot. So it's a great kind of seg into that. Before we kind of talk about what you've been doing the show recently, how did that come around, by the way? Like, how did you end up being one of the fronts for that?
Yeah, so I moved to work for Newsbeat on Radio 1. I used to work for BBC Wales, surprise, surprise. I don't know what gave it away.
Jamaican accent.
Yeah, that's what it is. So I used to work there, and then about 5 years ago moved to work on Radio 1, and we had a tech reporter at the time was looking at tech stuff, but he was so busy because there's loads of technology stuff happening. And a gaming event came up, and he was like, oh, can anybody go to this Halo event? And it was the Halo Master Chief Collection on the Xbox. And I was like, I like gaming, I'll go along. And that was it, sort of snowballed from there. Then we did a special program, and then he was busy doing the other tech stuff, so like, well, I'll keep picking up the gaming stuff. And so we do lots of stories on Newsbeat, so on the radio and online, and then we started experimenting with some YouTube stuff, and at the same time then Radio 1 were looking at putting a gaming show on the iPlayer, and we were both working on something at the same time, so we brought it together. And so it means that we produce some of them, and I present on them with Julia Hardy, who's like, you know, knows everybody in the gaming industry, and you know, so we have lots of fun together on the show, looking at sort of themes of big issues and big changes in the industry and stuff. So we've done a whole range of stuff from going to E3, the big shows, to, you know, like looking at remakes or looking at, you know, Call of Duty, FIFA. We've done, you know, you name it, we've looked at it on the show.
Yeah, I was actually rewatching one of the recent episodes where you were creating new games as well. That was interesting.
That was fun. Well, it's, you know, as a journalist, I find it's difficult for me just to chat about stuff without, I can't help it, but I've got to ask questions about stuff. Why do you do it like this? Why is it like that? What does this mean for so and so? And, you know, there's loads of new games coming out, but we're just looking at it. It's like a lot of the, if you look at big games these days, they're usually remakes, reversionings, franchises we've seen before. You know, the big games that come out every year, FIFA, Call of Duty, and they're brilliant games in their own right. I spend most of my time when I'm not trying to finish Red Dead Redemption playing Blackout. Right? I love Call of Duty as much as the next man. But where we were looking online, and we're seeing people asking the question, where's the new stuff? Where are the new franchises that in 10 years' time people are going to say, oh my God, we're playing the sequel of so-and-so? And so, you know, the gaming industry needs to have a mix of both, I think it's probably fair to say. And so we were just looking in this latest show, how do you find that balance? And it was really interesting because we had a range of perspectives, but people telling us about how they look, publishers out there looking at indie games and deciding whether or not they should back them or not, and what sells a game to them, what makes it unique and different. And it was really fun. Plus we got to do some painting, and I'm absolutely terrible at arts and crafts, as you discover in this episode.
That weren't a strongest subject of school, was it, bruv?
What can I say, Marcus? I can't say anything, it's awful.
You can't be good at everything, alright mate? There you go.
And Julie's really arty, so in the show we sort of sell this concept of, you know, where the new ideas in gaming by us going to an art studio and having to come up with our own characters for a game.
Yeah.
And Julia's very, very creative. She comes up with this quite nicely painted, you know, really sort of conceptual creation, and I just draw a man with massive muscles.
Yeah, I was like, that's, I was looking at it thinking, yeah, that's probably what I'd try and draw, and I wouldn't do that very well either. But you know, sometimes you just gotta have strong stick man game.
Yeah,
I reckon that's what it's all about, strong stick man game.
Yeah, but it's been really fun. So Newsbeat obviously is part of Radio 1, so we do the news on the station, but also we're part of BBC News, and so it's been interesting for us to be doing news features about games, but also doing entertainment programs about games as well, where we ask questions that are interesting and relevant to people, but also have a bit of fun while we do it.
Would you say it's fair to say that gaming is a massive part of youth culture, kind of almost overlooked until very recently by a lot of people?
I was giving a presentation recently about this, you know, a couple of weeks ago. The games industry in the UK was valued at £5.7 billion. It's massive.
Yeah.
But that number in isolation doesn't really mean anything. You know, what is that big? Is it small? I don't really know. But when you say that it's worth more than music and movies combined in the UK, I think that gives you an indication of just how big this industry is. And you know, the numbers of one in three people in the UK play a game every day. So you know, you can't, the change in the industry from what it was 30 years ago, where people thought it was, you know, men in their pants sitting in dark rooms playing Space Invaders or whatever.
Now it's men in sexy ass pajamas playing games.
Yes.
in dark rooms.
In dark rooms.
Yeah.
And there's still an element of that. And then, yeah, of course, the, you know, games are for everybody. If you want to sit in your pants in a dark room and play games all day, then you crack on, you do you. That's fine.
Yeah.
But it's also, if you want to play a mobile experience that'll last you 45 minutes on the train, then you're a gamer too. Come and join us, get involved. You know, what games are these days has totally changed. So the BAFTAs were last week, right? BAFTA Games. So as in my research, so we were doing news coverage for the BBC, not just for Newsbeat, but for all of the BBC on that day, about what was happening. So past my research was looking at all the games that were nominated, because so many games come out these days, and gaming is a part of my job, but it's not the only thing I do. So sometimes a game will slip through the net and I don't get to play them all, which is a shame. I'd love to just sit there playing them all day. So I played the mobile game, which, to be fair, mates of mine have been telling me for a while, you should play this, called Florence. Have you tried it?
Yeah. Oh man,
beautiful.
What a game.
Right, but it's over in, you know, it's not very long.
Oh, yeah, short game, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's a game now. You know, my wife, who wouldn't necessarily, you know, quit, or my sister, who wouldn't, you know, think of themselves as gamers, sat down and played that start to finish. And so you've got those experiences, and basically the game, if you haven't played it, it's a mobile game, and you live the life of a woman who's so 25-year-old who's falling in love, and, spoiler alert, the relationship doesn't necessarily work out. It's a little puzzle game. It's beautiful. Monument Valley, another mobile game, you know, a puzzle game. The stuff these games can do now. And also then you've got my Call of Duty, where I want to shoot as many people as possible in a short space of time and shout at the screen and get frustrated and do all of that stuff. You know, if somebody kills you in Blackout when you're down to the last 10 and they've snuck up behind you, there is nothing more frustrating. But that's the beauty of games now compared to what it used to be, is you've got this huge spectrum of stuff that you can get stuck in, get involved with. When I'm on a big, I know I've got a long flight coming up in June, I've got Football Manager on my Switch, and that's what I'm going to spend 7 hours doing, thank you very much. And there's that range of experiences out there for you.
Yeah, I think the BAFTAs really took time to kind of really show the whole spectrum of gaming as well. And by the way, Stefan was looking sharp.
That's very good.
Oh mate, that was a
you look good yourself, to be fair.
Oh man, I just threw on a quick suit, but Stefan had the whole was it a 3-piece, 5-piece, 12-piece?
I mean, I went 3-piece.
Yeah, man.
So controversial. What do you think about this, man? I should have asked you this before. So it's a black tie event, right?
Yeah, man.
But it's not really black tie.
Yeah, it's gamers, isn't it? So they were just, this is what I love about it. It's like black tie. I was asking people, when you say black tie, full penguin, they were like, black tie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but go on.
So my 3-piece, which I was quite pleased with.
Yeah.
But it was navy.
It's all right.
Do you think that's okay?
It's cool. Nah, you had the, was it the Dickie bow? You had the Dickie
bow? I had Dickie bow, I had a jazzy tie.
That was it, yeah, jazzy tie. Remember the colours on that? Yeah, I reckon that was a good look.
Fine. It's too late now anyway, so.
It's done now. Yeah. If it was like a dinner do, like a three course dinner do, I think that's where everybody's kind of got. No, if it specifically says black tie only, then I'll take it.
It doesn't say that. And I know we've been to the BAFTAs every year for the past few years, and it's a loose black tie, isn't it?
It is.
So I think it went okay. But thanks for noticing.
Yeah, no, you're looking sharp, man. And I think being there at the BAFTAs and kind of, even if you just take time to look at the nominations and such, if you don't go there, kind of makes you realise how big the industry is, because there's quite literally Hollywood actors, you know, and high level television actors that get incorporated into some of these games, you know, so like God of War, which swept up this year, do you know what I mean?
I think rightly so as well for me.
It's
subjective, and there's some obviously other games out there, and you know, we've been talking about Red Dead 2 earlier, and I suppose that was a shock that it didn't win anything.
Yeah.
But for me, I think God of War was the complete package for me last year. I thought it was really, really clever, especially because they did so much with. They changed that character, and he was there, wasn't he, Christopher Judge? And I've been lucky enough; I got to interview him this year, and what a voice!
Oh, he actually sounds like that in real life.
Yeah, he does.
Like,
he does. He's not putting it on.
Yeah. He's like a big man as well. Yeah. Like, so if you're old enough to remember like Stargate SG-1, he played sort of like the warrior type out of their crew, and it's easy to forget just how much of a physical man he's. Like, he's got a great booming voice and kind of the body to go around it. When you go up to him and shake his hand, it's like he's holding your arm up to your elbow when he's shaking it. He's like, nice to meet you.
Yeah, you can take your feet off the ground.
Casually. Also, he was wearing a jazzy RC.
I was going to say,
oh, geez.
That snake skin number. Woo. Oh, if you haven't seen it, check it out.
We'll throw a picture up on the Twitter. He was looking fire.
It was impressive.
Yeah.
So that made me feel better about the Navy when I saw that. I was like, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone would stand out next to him. He was looking loud.
Yeah.
But there were just some great games. Like, I feel like they really went across the board, and they've got kind of, the fact that they've got awards for like mobile gaming experiences and for sort of original property, which is quite interesting as well. You were talking about new games that came out. So it wasn't just, they took time to kind of make sure that they weren't just celebrating, you know, nothing wrong with it, God of War, because it could have just been the God of War awards, you know what I mean? Or the Red Dead 2 awards.
And I think in the gaming industry, you have awards that do look at more popular. Well, it's not popular, because of course these games are popular because they're doing well, but games that, you know, they get more mainstream attention than, should we say, because you've got the Golden Joysticks, which are sort of largely voted for by gamers, and so the BAFTAs are supposed to sort of take a step back from that. Interesting though, when you look at what gamers are playing and what was nominated, there is a little bit of a bit of attention there, and there's, people say this about the Oscars every year, like, you know, Moonlight is an amazing film, not many people saw it, it still wins an Oscar, so it's trying to get that balance right of like, well, this is a really popular game, millions of people have bought it and are playing it every day, but, you know, so there are games that are out there that fit that category that didn't get nominated, so it's trying to get, you know, have they got that balance right between games that are clearly, you know, well made, beautiful games that tell a fantastic story, but less people are playing them compared to these big blockbusters that are also really technically good, more people are playing them. Where's the balance in between that? I think in the end, you can't really argue with the people that won the awards, but it is an interesting tension, I think, sometimes in the industry between what's popular and what's good, and also it's so subjective, isn't it, what I like and what you like.
It's just massive.
It's different.
It's just a massive industry, so to be able to, you know, say that you like a game and to know that there's a massive audience, even if they're not in that room, that follow it, like old school RuneScape when that got announced,
they were mad, didn't they?
It was the loudest cheer of the night, I've got to be honest. Like, people were going off, and I was just like, a game that I understand is big, played a little bit of and isn't really a bit of me, I was like, wow, like, this is why this game won that award.
Yeah, what is brilliant about that, you know, the BAFTAs, I think, and we, in our lead up to our coverage, is that in one category you had Red Dead Redemption 2, you know, one of the games cost a lot of money to make, hundreds of people put that together, a labour of love that lasted years. in the same category, best British game against Two Point Hospital.
Yeah.
You know, which is made in Farnham, just the outskirts of London, with a small team. And we went and we filmed with them before, and they were like, we're really pleased to be nominated. Look, we're up against this guy. You know, and two totally different experiences, but, you know, put together in the same category. I think that's really cool.
So as a guy that's kind of consuming quite a few games and your research in that area, with things like the Labo, sitting next to a PlayStation 4 and, you know, mobile gaming, like what's going to happen in the future as mobile tech is kind of catching up with regards to what it's got inside it? You know, we've got the Switch is a great example. Mm. That kind of is the perfect crossover from phone, tablet to kind of mainstream console. Do you think we're going to go into a direction where kind of every device that we have can sort of access the same game, kind of like with Fortnite and such?
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, you look at Google also getting involved now. Oh, yeah. And they're going down the sort of the streaming route.
Right? Shows you how big it is when Google want to get involved.
I don't think anybody's really got the answer at the moment. They don't really know. You know, there's a lot of people are suggesting that it's less the device route that the answer lies in, but it's more the access to the game. So it is this idea of streaming, so you'll be able to play the same game regardless of whether it's on your phone or whether it's on a proper console, so that's the more the approach some people are arguing we're going down, rather than creating a device that can sort of cross all of them. So like the Switch is the first, and maybe you might go down that line. Interestingly, I just don't think people know. I think you're going to get a lot of people sort of experimenting with stuff until something sticks. Because if you look at VR, I can remember doing interviews at E3 3-4 years ago, and top level developers looking me in the eye and saying, this is 100% the future of the gaming industry. In a couple of years' time, everybody is going to have a VR headset. You know, this is where the games industry is going. Now, some people will point, I'm sure, will listen and they'll say, oh, well, there's quite good sales figures for headsets, and there's, you know, there are X many they've sold across the world. But it doesn't, you don't have people sitting in the pub saying, oh my God, I play that amazing VR game. You've got to go and get it. It's not there yet. And, you know, so for all that energy and you know, people are still, you know, I know Oculus have got a new thing coming out, and the PSVR, I'm sure, will have an update soon. And, you know, people aren't giving up on the VR experiment. Of course they're not. But it hasn't been the smash hit that people were expecting it to be.
Yeah.
And I think that because people don't really know what's going to land with gamers. And I think the Switch could have gone, you know, Nintendo, it was a risky move. Was it going to work? Was it not going to work? And I think it has worked. I think people, the fact you can play it on the bus, play it at home, that's really cool. So Nobody really knows the answer. This streaming stuff, the Google, you know, getting involved in it, and you've got Xbox with their Game Pass, and, you know, this idea that, you know, that you can access games on demand, like a Netflix of gaming sort of thing, is really interesting, could be the answer. You try playing that in rural Glenammon, where I'm from, where the Wi-Fi is, you can barely send a WhatsApp message. You know?
Ain't happening, mate. You know? Ain't happening,
I can barely get on the internet. I live in central London. Right? You know, so, you know, my dad can barely send me an email because, you know, the internet's not great where we're from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my dad's like that. That's just because he's my dad.
So, I mean, I don't want to cop. I don't want to sit on the fence here either, mate. But I just feel like I don't think we really know. And it's an exciting time. People are trying all this stuff out. Ultimately, I still think that games are king. And whatever device has got the best games on, that's where the gamers are going to be. And that's where I think PlayStation over the past few years have sold more than Xbox, because they've had the games. And that's sort of basically, I think, been the point of difference.
Do you know what? We've got true for that. We have a Xbox fanatic in the studio. Our producer, Billy, loves Xbox. And he recently sent us a message, all the presenters, saying, what's your PS tag? Because
Billy,
I've come over because Spider-Man. It was Spider-Man that won him over. Spider-Man brought him over. And it's it's very interesting you said that, because I think that's a very important strategy from PlayStation. I think last E3 was kind of a lot of games companies throwing their cards out and saying, these are the games we've got. Spider-Man, just for me, was one of the games that I was like, if this game is as good as they say it is, what the version that we're playing now is really going to make people buy consoles. And Billy is proof of that. Do you know what I mean?
Does it feel like you're cheating on the missus, Billy?
No, not really, yeah.
Oh. He's just relentless.
It got a bit stale, because there's not very many good games exclusives on Xbox. All the exclusives, the good ones, are on PlayStation.
Yeah, well, and that's what, you know, a lot of gamers felt the same as Billy, and that's why, you know, PlayStation sales were better. Although, interestingly, now you do get a sort of end of an era feel with the PlayStation, don't you? You know, now that you know, God of War, Spider-Man, you talked about. We know that Last of Us 2 is coming at some point, which is, you know, I know we talked about original games earlier, but some in that program that we made about original games, Julia makes a really good point. She's like, obviously it's important that, you know, the games industry is coming up with new things, new ideas, but sometimes you just want to go back to what you know and love and want to find out more. And she's, and I'm the same, really excited about finding out what's going to happen with that Last of Us story, because the first game also cried playing that one. I don't cry playing all games, right, but I did have to play. So, you know, so we know we've got that coming. We know they've got Death Stranding coming at some point, the new Kojima game. But you do get a sense that they're sort of winding down. They're not going to be at E3 this year.
Yeah, that's that was a, that's big news though. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, they just, you know, because possibly because they've got nothing new to say or show, and so, and then you're waiting for PlayStation 5 whenever that's going to come. But it means that Xbox, interestingly, you know, Billy's moved over. I've got a bit of room to sort of step into. So you know that they've already teased before that, you know, some big franchises, you know, Halo is going to be coming back at some point. Gears of War is going to be coming back at some point. So whether or not they're going to be able to make up enough ground by the time we've moved on to talk about the next generation of consoles.
But what's also interesting as well, and we've seen Rockstar employ this method as well, you can actually just port the game over to the next console, and GTA 5 did really well. They kind of dropped at the end of the lifespan of the PS3, really, and it was kind of a situation where if you still wanted to play the game, you'd be like, oh, all right, just I'll get the PS4 version. Do you know what I mean? Good timing for Red Dead Redemption 2, actually.
You look at the Nintendo Switch, right?
Yes.
People bought that because Zelda was on it. Now, you could still play Zelda on the Wii U, but I want the better Zelda. I love Zelda, and I waited a long time for this Zelda game to come out. So I want the best Zelda experience I can get, and to do that, I need the Switch, so I'm going to buy that. Yeah. And so you can see that possibly Last of Us, Death Stranding, Red Dead Redemption 2, those sorts of games will be playable. Probably, I haven't got any jazzy insight for you here. This is just, you know, off the top of my head. Surely those games are going to be playable on your PS5 when it comes, so that people, I know I'm going to get an amazing experience when I buy this.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I look forward to it, man. I look forward to hearing about your coverage of E3 as well. We're still in two minds whether we're going to be out there or not because of the whole Sony thing as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you don't, it's a lot of us up in the air. I think a lot of the companies themselves don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Is Google going to be there? Yeah. Surely this is the time
that
for them to...
That could be a big gap for them to fill in that vacuum.
It kind of makes sense, right? Because there's not going to be Sony announcements, or, you know, Microsoft are probably rubbing their hands with glee thinking, here we go, it's a chance for us to get some stuff out there. Nintendo, I think, are interesting at this E3 because, you know, talking about games that sell consoles, we know that Nintendo fans were desperate for a new Mario game. They've got it. They were desperate for a new Zelda game. They've got it. They were desperate for a new Super Smash Bros.
Got it.
Got it.
Yeah.
I think we've heard that there's no Metroid coming soon. So what's next for the Switch that's going to keep people as excited as they have been over those games? Is it a new Mario Kart? Don't know, because the 8's technically a remake, isn't
it? Yeah, that was a zhuzh up of the last
version. I mean, to be fair, it's a pretty good zhuzh up.
Oh,
well,
sick. Oh, yeah, it was deluxe. That was it. It was the deluxe version.
It was deluxe. It was very deluxe. So, so what have they got coming out? And some of them, you know, the big publishers then, in terms of, you know, Call of Duty, Ubisoft, what are we going to see from them? So it will be an interesting year, but the vacuum from Sony is going to be filled by someone, and who that is, we don't know yet.
Interesting. We'll make sure you keep in touch with Stefan on his socials as well, because you are always tweeting out bits and bobs. Brexit as well.
Brexit, my Welsh rugby.
Yeah, that's it.
So sorry about those in advance if you're not a rugby man. NFL, politics and games. It's a bit of a weird, combo on that Twitter feed.
Yeah, you love a bit of American football, is it?
I'm obsessed.
You've had quite a bit of an involvement in it.
Yeah, so I used to play.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to play in university. So I used to, grew up, always loved sport, watch anything, Aussie rule, you name it. Put it on when I was a kid, I'd watch it. Loved NFL growing up, and I followed the Oakland Raiders, and around about 2003 they were really good. They got to the Super Bowl. I was like, yes, I'm in, this is my team, I'm going to support them. Look, they're doing really well. They got to the final, they lost, but still they're going to be good. Ever since then, they've been one of the worst teams in the league by an absolute stretch. They've been terrible, but I still love them. My phone case is the Raiders. I've been to see them in LA and in London, well, just outside LA, Oakland, and in London. And I follow it religiously, obsessed. So I played in university, for the Cardiff University Cobras. It was so much fun.
Cardiff Cobras.
Yeah, it's good alliteration.
Yeah, I like that, man. Yeah.
It's fab. So I loved it, absolutely loved it. I mean, the standard isn't fantastic, but there was loads of us. Made some mates for life as well, which is probably the most fun thing. I met my wife. My wife was a cheerleader.
Your wife was a player. I was like, oh, man, mixed teams.
Yeah,
good stuff.
She was a cheerleader, so that's how we met. And so I loved playing, but then I bust my knee up playing, so I had to coach then for a bit. So I loved it.
So you did a bit of coaching then?
Bit of coaching. It was you have offensive and defensive coaches, as a defensive coordinator coming up with all the plays and all this stuff. It was really fun.
Sick. It's very technical with regards to that, isn't it?
Yeah. Somebody once described it to me as chess with helmets. Which I can roll with that. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I've seen like some of those plays that you get down, they're super complex, right?
And they change depending on what the other person does. So if you run this way, it means, okay, I don't do this. So if you run that way, then I do this. And it changes depending on what happens.
Sick. Yeah. And where did you play, by the way? Like, what was your position?
So my position is a position called cornerback.
Right.
So basically, if you don't know the NFL, at one point, the quarterback throws the ball, right? And somebody's got to try and catch it. So your job as a cornerback is to stop the other dude from catching the ball. Or if he does catch it, then tackle him.
Action packed.
Yeah, well, it's really quiet, and then it's funny, if you're doing a good job, nobody notices you, but if you mess up, everybody's like, what do you do that for? Because they usually score a touchdown.
Oh man, alright. Yeah. I'm not that into NFL. I mean, I watch the big games.
Yeah,
but I just feel like it's I think Nick Bright explained a bit to me, because he started following it, and I get it. Like, but at the end of the game, I kind of understand everything that's going on. By the time it gets to me watching another game, I kind of forget what's happening. But it's by yards, isn't it?
So it is by yards. It's basically, for me, it's a mix of rugby league and cricket.
Yeah.
And if you bear with me, I'll join those dots. So in rugby league, you get 6 attempts to score. If you don't, the other team get the ball back. It's like that in American football, but you get 4 attempts to make 10 yards, and if you do it, then you get to go again. And then it's like cricket, because you go and watch a cricket match, you go and watch England playing a test match, it takes all day. Sometimes you're watching the game, sometimes you're drinking, sometimes you're chatting to your mates, sometimes you're switching in. And it's like that with the NFL. It's not like our football, where you're zoned in, concentrating, normally sweating or screaming at the team or the ref or whatever for 90 minutes. It's less of an intense focus for that prolonged period of time. You sort of dip in and out. And then when it gets to a certain point where something big's about to happen, then you switch on. Right. What I love about the NFL is that 3 hours of action turns on 1 second of magic or somebody's mistake or whatever. And you can be coached within an inch of your life, but somebody will just do something spontaneous and it tears the whole thing apart and it starts again. And that's why I fell in love with the game.
Sick. Are you into quite a few other American things as well? I've got down here that you're a fan of a burger.
I absolutely love hamburgers.
So, wow, the look on Stefan's face when I said that. What about burgers is, if you got, I like a burger, but the look on your face.
I tell you what, I mean, the light on his face
right
now.
Go, hit me with it, man.
So there's, I don't know, ever since I was a kid, I've loved burgers and fries. We went to America when I was lucky enough to go to America with my family when I was about 14, 15.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with it, you know. And so now the good thing is, in the UK, is the sort of the burger restaurant, the burger and fry place is becoming quite, you know, it's quite trendy now.
It's getting better,
yeah. It's getting better. So everywhere, so the UK has upped its burger game, which is fantastic. But I can remember when I first moved to London, I was trying to shift a couple of pounds. On the way into work, I walked past 6 different burger joints. I was like, come on. cut the man some slack. So yeah, I like it. And me and my wife, we go around, we try different burger places out. And then I've got sort of, when I go to different, you asked.
Go for it,
when
man.
We go to different places, I judge the burger joint on sort of 3 different criteria. So one, there's the patty itself, that's just the meat.
Just the meat. Yeah.
2, the burger as a whole. So you're talking how the patty mixes with the bun. Is it a brioche bun? Is it toasted? Is it not toasted? What's the condiments? Is there lettuce, non-lettuce, onions, non-onions? Is there a sauce, et cetera, et cetera, right? Whack that all together. And then 3, atmosphere of the place.
Oh, wow.
Because for me, I've got places where the bun is brilliant, but the meat's a bit whatever, or the meat is amazing but the bun's a bit rubbish, and the atmosphere is flat. And so judging on those three criteria, then we've got our favourite places that we go to.
So what constitutes a good atmosphere? Like,
oh, you just want it to be lively, you want to have people sort of chatting, having fun around you, you don't want to be going somewhere that's silent, you don't want the music to be too loud because you can't chat with whoever you're with, but also you don't want it to be too quiet so you feel like you're in a library, you know. It's an interesting mix. Is it a burger and a beer sort of a place, or is it somewhere you go to on a night out, or is it a burger and a shake sort of a place, was more of a lunch thing, you know? There's a lot, there's some variables in there.
You're going down a rabbit hole,
yeah,
mate.
There
I
are
like
variables
this.
There and the states, mind, I'll say that I'm lucky enough that I get to travel at a fair amount with work, usually through the gaming stuff. So we've been to Japan and Korea and you know, to meet really interesting developers or get access to games and see things that really sort of shine a light on the industry for the audience at home. But going to America is always great because burger joints.
I can't lie. I think one of my favourite joints out there is In-N-Out. First thing, it's the first thing I hit when I come out of LAX.
Do you animal your fries up?
Oh, cool. Listen, I'm a double-double.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Animal fries.
Yeah.
And then if I've just landed, I'll get the Neapolitan shake as well. That's where they put all the flavours of the milkshake in.
Yeah, do it. Yeah.
I love. Oof.
I mean, there's so many. So
animal style
if
fries.
If you do go to, if you do choose to go to E3 this year, we're gonna have a conversation because In-N-Out is obviously a very famous fast food place out there.
Yeah, it's the West Coast, isn't it?
Yeah, so exactly.
Yeah.
But there are some other sneaky ones I'll have to tell you about.
You got the in, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I love it. I really enjoy it.
Right, okay. Right. So, because I'm over here, I've got a few places that I like, but I feel like after having a few burgers in the States, I come back here and I'm like, it's good. But what is it that makes an American burger different?
I don't know. Because on paper, it's basically the same, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and arguably, Britain's famed for its meat all over the world. We sell meat all over the world. And so what? So it can't be the meat. I don't know what it is.
A bit of it must be the atmosphere. A bit of it must be the American atmosphere.
I think maybe, you know, then you've got an American waitress or waiter, and they're very attentive and they're refilling your drinks or even you haven't got to look at them.
Yeah.
And maybe that's it.
So really, that's what you like to do to kill time. You're a burger connoisseur out there.
It's one of the things.
How many burgers do you have a week? You said you're losing a bit of weight.
I'm trying to stay trim. Yeah, so to be fair, I'm really rationing it at the moment. So when I go to the States, I'd really try and make sure that I could have one twice a day, every day, so I try to limit one. So at the moment, I'm trying to have about, I don't know, two a month, something like that, once a fortnight, which is really hard.
That's so hard for you, bro.
It's really tough.
Look on you. You look like
it's really tough.
Stefan's face looks upset. He's like, one every 2 weeks,
bro. You know. And then what happens is when I say, "No, I've had a couple."
Yeah,
and it's the end of a night.
Yeah, oh,
you know, and then you have one. They're like, "Oh, that's such a waste."
Yeah,
I've wasted my allocation for the week. I can't have another one now because I've just waited. And you don't really taste it properly.
You scoff that day. You breathe it in.
You've had a few beers. You know, maybe you've moved on to the G&Ts afterwards. You know, a couple of tequilas. Oh, great! I'll have something on the way home, and then I can't go to wait another 2 weeks before I can have a burger.
Wow. Well, you know what? I look forward to trying some burgers with you in the States, man. I mean, that might be the thing that brings me over to E3 now. But now, cheers for coming on the show, man.
No,
do you
want
to share with everyone how they can find you online?
Yeah, of course. So it's at Stefan Powell. So it's STEFFAN Powell, POWELL, on Twitter and Instagram. And there we'll be sharing all the sort of gaming stuff that we talk about on Newsbeat and on the Radio and Gaming Show as well, and the other documentaries we do with some random chat about burgers and Welsh rugby thrown in.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. And now we're going to be joined by Claire and Matt, who are the producer and director behind The Risen Possession, which is a film that has some great talent in it, including myself.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, guys. How's it going?
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
Do you want to introduce yourselves by name, just in case anyone gets Claire and Matt mixed up, obviously, because you sound so alike, yeah?
Well, I'm Matt.
Yeah.
And I'm Claire.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So thanks for coming down the show today, man. The Risen Possession.
Yes.
I know a bit about it, obviously.
Did you?
Yeah. I was the guy that just kept on sneaking onto set all the time. But what is it about? Like, because there's like a whole Risen world, isn't there? So... There is a universe.
We were literally just talking about this.
Yeah.
When we were like, how do you explain it?
Yes.
We had like a short version and a long version.
Go on, you do your version.
It
should be long.
It's a Lovecraftian sci-fi action horror extravaganza made for 25p. And it is the... Okay, 24p. I don't know why he's laughing. It's because he knows how much it was. It is, for us, it was the second part in a two-part story, but it's a standalone film. It's about a group of urban explorers who wander themselves into a military complex and happen upon the door to, let's call it, chaos.
Yeah.
Daughter Chaos.
Yeah, we've kind of created, well, there's two films, as Matt said.
Yeah.
So we've kind of created this complete world within these films, which is pretty crazy, but amazing at the same time.
Yeah. The part one to the film was set in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
And that was set in the 50s just after the Second World War. And it's sort of based on the urban myths of the military. Experimenting, should we say, with not just psychedelics, but also with soldiers and stuff like that.
Because there was a time, this is an actual thing, by the way, so I'm not just, like, bugging out on mad YouTube videos, but there was a time when the military were quite experimental with things that they did, some of the stuff that you see in sci-fi films like The Risen and The Risen Possession, they're not too far off some of the things that they proposed to at least try and freeze the budget at. Because there was a time when the army had a lot of fucking money and a lot of people with ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some, whether you call them amazing or not, inventions, or should we say devastating inventions that they made. There are also a lot of other things out there that were really kooky when you look back at them.
Crazy. When you were writing that, we were discussing that. I remember us having a conversation. Yeah, the government really, other governments kind of properly experimented. But yeah, it's really crazy.
So the MK Ultra program and that sort of stuff. So you can't, I feel like there's a little bit of a touch of that in there, Matt, as well, because you wrote it, right?
Yeah, for my sins. There was a lot of that, like, porting down as the kind of easy for you to spray, mythologically, this kind of UK version of MK Ultra, which was the CIA was happily experimenting on soldiers with psychedelics and God knows what else, and hypnotism and some really, I say kooky, but it's shitballs crazy stuff. I mean, really, God knows what they're doing now. Porting Down was the British sort of version of that, essentially. And so if you give Google a couple of pages into Google, and shit starts to get real weird on it. And it's kind of fun, and it's easy to fall down that rabbit hole, like the YouTube video rabbit hole, for example. It's worth a Google.
So as someone who was part of the program, how was that for you?
It was okay. I feel like I came out the other side with a couple of problems, but other than that, I'm good both inside and out. Who asked the question?
Sick. So this is what Matt's like, by the way. He was like this on set all the time. Just to clarify, I didn't actually tell the listeners in this episode, but I'm actually one of the characters in the film.
Amazing.
We'll get to that in a bit, but like, Claire, your partnership producing, right? So that's like, a lot of people don't understand the sheer amount of work that you also have to do to make a film come together. Like, talk us through like what your role is as a producer, because a lot of people, honestly, they're like, oh, you just they just make it happen. I'm like, do a lot more than that, bro.
So a producer would find the script to begin with, and then craft the script, and then make the script happen and deliver the final film. That's the brief kind of synopsis of what a producer does. But the producer is there all the way sculpting it and helping the director's vision and getting the investors, the entire kind of process, and in the end delivering the film as promised, basically.
Yeah, so you're like literally pulling it together, like, but you're kind of have contact points of every single part that kind of happens with it. Yeah. But you didn't really have to work as hard finding the scripts, because I know you guys got relationships.
Well, shit, when I... She worked very hard.
Yeah, this ain't your first film, though, is it, really? So you've done a few, right?
This is our fourth film. Fifth film.
Yeah,
so we obviously own Lost Eye Films.
Yeah.
And I think we made our first film, Gangster Guns and Zombies, and then Matt shoved the Risen script in front of me and instantly fell in love with it.
Was it two parts when you wrote it, or was it the first?
It was just one, to begin with.
We were chatting about this earlier because we were trying to figure out, because for us it's like we do a lot of work over Skype at the moment, and we have a piece of paper with trigger warning written on it.
Yeah.
And any time, because we're sort of dragging these films over the finish line, they're really low budget extravaganzas. It's just been a fucking nightmare. So as it is for any independent filmmaker, but it's been really hard. And so We're on Skype chatting, and every time anything's coming up, we're like a piece of paper with trigger warning on it, because we've got PTSD about the films.
Mm. We also have one that says nice.
We do have one that says nice, but nice is a recent one.
Yep.
That's a pretty recent one, yeah. we were talking about, like, oh shit, we're going to go and see Marcus. Like, we're going to get these kind of questions. So we're like, what the fuck did it come from? And we're trying to rack our brains back, because it's a good like four or five years ago or something. Like,
we made two films in between getting The Risen ready.
Like, that's fucking crazy. So like the Risen was originally a script called The Tunnel, and it was we were just desperately trying to make something that we could make for as little as possible. And so the idea of a repeating location was the basis of that film, and that film then became The Risen. We then, do I say this? So I'm just checking. So the Risen was originally just one film, and we were advised basically through a friend and who's an executive, who became an executive producer on the film. It's like, in order to get the money together to make the one film at such a crazy low budget, we'd have to make two films. Because once the sets are made and the costumes are bought and all the rest of it is there and done, you may as well try and get the extra money to make a second film, and then that'll be better for investors and all the rest of it.
Which was sound advice, mental advice, but sound.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, yeah. Because the nicest thing you could do is make two films back to back when you don't have enough money to make one film properly. Mm. So that's how the Risen Possession came about, straight from the Risen. But we're talking like 4 or 5 years of work. Graft.
Yeah. And you like double down on the film, but you also double down on like on everything else. Everything. And it's more than that. All right, cool. So like the second film,
more importantly, the second
obviously
film,
like, all about the second film.
Ladies and gentlemen, Marcus plays Adam in the film.
Let's see how much is on the cutting floor.
You've not seen a cut yet, have you?
I did the DVD commentary with you.
Oh yes, that was it.
Yeah, so we did. Yeah, did that. Good. Fucking hell, Matt. Yeah. Good memory there. been partying, bro.
I get hit in the head a lot.
That's what I live with. I live with that.
What day is it today?
You're Matt.
Yeah.
Who?
Actually, before that, between both of the films, though, there's quite a... there's quite a lot of choreographed fighting scenes in there, and I think you're quite heavy handed in that, isn't it, Matt? Because you're pretty handy with your hands, isn't it? You've got two lethal weapons there. You got a license for those. What way to the gun show?
Yes, I we had no money, so And I come from a martial arts background, but a little bit of stunt choreography background. So
and an MK Ultra background.
And an MK Ultra background. Yeah, we had military training, obviously. Yeah,
cool.
I can't remember none of that shit. I'm high as fuck. But yes, anytime there was any sort of stunts needed, I was kind of top of the list to have to fall downstairs or get hit in the head or whatever. But those are some of the most fun things, really.
When you were telling me a story earlier, obviously the producer on these two crazy films didn't see this happening because I was upstairs trying to put 1,000 fires out. But weren't you telling me a story earlier about a crash mat and one of the actors?
We're going to get sued.
No, you'd be fine. Go for it.
Was it one of the first films? Okay, cool.
I think we did a little bit of this in the second film, but the first film, basically one of the stunts was in the first film. Our lead lady has to, like, there's a blind baddie's running down the tunnel. She steps to the side of the tunnel and clung hits her with a crowbar in the head, and this blind sort of gets hit in the head and then leaps up into the air flat and then lands flat on its back on the floor off a shot. Now the tunnels are like a couple of meters, maybe three meters wide, if that. So this guy's got a nice run up. That was the stunt. Was in one shot where we're over the shoulder of our lead lady, looking past her as she swings this crowbar. He runs just slightly outside of it, so that the shot's covered. We don't see her miss him essentially, but it looks like she connects. So he had to whip his head back and jump up into the air, lie flat in the air, and then fall down flat out of shot.
Yeah.
But because of the width of the tunnel, that meant there's no matting. It's just a solid concrete floor. So obviously, if he lands on the floor, he's going to really hurt himself. And he had on a mask as well. It was one of the bad guys. They're blinds, and so he's literally blind. He's just running down the hall, and when we shout now, he whips his head back and jumps up into the air. One of my fondest memories is this poor kid, because he's like, he was a student that we'd got down who was helping out, and he just happened to be he knew one of the guys who was a gaffer, so he was a mate of someone, so he became the blind, and he thought he was just being run up and down, and suddenly he's doing this ridiculous stunt, and I'm going to him, okay, so you get hit with the crowbar, and like, she's swinging this full crowbar at him, then you just jump up into the air like as high as you can, lay flat like you're planking, and then just fall down out of shot, and dude, I will slide a crash mat underneath you won't even notice it, you'll land, it'll be fine. But
he's like, yeah.
The kid's like, okay. Like, he's got that mask off of his head, looking me deep in the eye, going, okay.
I trust you.
Yeah. And then we start rolling. And he goes up the other end of the hall and starts running. And I'm like, fuck, I hope I don't miss. Like, not only do I hope I don't miss, I hope Laura doesn't miss. Because if she's like a couple of inches, she gets excited and swings out, she's going to clock him in the head. He'd be dead. You fall down dead, we have to bury him out of the back.
With
the rest of them. that was one of my most fun. Yeah. So I think that's why I was recounting that.
Yeah.
I was saying, can we tell this story?
Of course.
I was saying that.
Yeah, we had insurance.
Yeah, did we?
Yes,
we did.
Do you remember in our first film, Gangster, Guns and Zombies? Sorry, Marcus.
Crack the fuck off.
Thanks for coming down, mate. Claire, tell me about what happened in our first film.
Do you remember our first film, Gangster, Guns and Zombies?
Yeah.
We had a load of extras come down to set, bless them. And Charlie is a big guy. Charlie Rawls, amazing actor, massive guy, muscles.
He's just done stuff with Jackie Chan.
Yeah, he had to throw one of the extras over a car.
I don't want to talk about it. Fuck.
And she landed on her head.
Yes, and then she came back in a neck brace the next day.
That's dedication.
She was amazing.
And she was like, no, it's fine.
Team?
She's like, yeah, she was on the netball team.
We had this scene like the day before where we had to have a load of zombies attack. A van. I don't know how we got a netball team. I don't know why that was. That was you. I don't know, being a genius. Anyway, this group of girls from a netball team came down, and they were the zombies. They had a great time.
Yeah, they were awesome.
Brilliant. But they must have been like, I don't know, let's say 18.
Yeah, they were young.
I'm shaking my head. They weren't 18. But anyway, so the next day, I didn't say it, did I? No, did you get it? No, you didn't. So they come to the next day. We have this stunt where Charlie has to throw over a car bonnet, and we didn't have a crash mat. And it was one of those sort of...
No, we had a crash mat.
Yes, we did.
No, we had a crash mat there.
Yes, we
Charlie
did.
Charlie missed and what? Threw her
so
on the bonnet.
So it's not our fault, it's Charlie's fault. Equally contacted at...
But she was in her 20s and she was great.
Yeah, she. But she came back.
I mean, she's got a long life to kind of, you know, get over it. Is she walking again now?
I don't.
She didn't say anything at the time, by the way.
Just knocked out.
Looking over and not getting up. I remember her not getting up. Like, because she was over the side of the car. I remember Charlie like looking over the side of the car, then looking back at me, and I'm going. Like thumbs up.
Yeah, she just carried
and
on.
She was just a
trooper. She didn't say anything. And I remember the next day we were shooting in this windmill. She came in with a neck brace, and we were like, "Oh my god, are you okay?" She's like, "Yeah, I'm fine."
Oh wow.
Yeah, but that's the take that's in the film.
I was going to say, you get the shot though.
Oh, yeah, we got
that shot.
Got that shot.
And she's totally safe, completely safe. Everything was fine.
So Claire, you mentioned actors. You managed to get some real good names for the Risen and Risen Possession, right? You got some hitters.
Yeah,
Marcus Bronzy.
Yeah, I was going to say we got Marcus.
Yeah, but apart from that charming, good-looking guy.
Marcus Bronzy.
Yeah. You got the Marcus Bronzy?
Yeah. The Marcus Bronzy.
There's a few fakers out there, so you know, you got the real one. But no, but you also got some like big UK talent, didn't you?
Yeah, we nearly got Roger Moore.
I remember you telling me that, and I was like,
I know. It was close.
That would have been
You had the wonderful Sally Phillips, and I got a little bit starstruck over Ade Edmondson.
Legend.
He was fucking brilliant.
Yeah,
he was cool.
How was it though? Like getting those kind of people. That's a big look. I mean, the script's amazing, and pulling them in. That's like.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard. It was, and we had 1,000 fires going on at the time. But I was. Good producers never give up, so I just kept going. Not saying I'm a good producer, but I just
kept
going.
She's a great producer.
The script was strong, you know. So. Yeah. I don't know.
We got one person, and then that was easy to get other people to agree then sometimes.
No, not really.
I fucking know.
Yeah. Stephen Marcus as well. Amazing.
Strong name.
From Lockstar.
Mm-hmm. He was fucking brilliant.
Yeah, we had some great talent.
Yeah. Brilliant, yeah.
Do you remember your audition?
Oh yeah.
See, I don't remember.
It was
unsurprisingly.
It was a hot day. I remember coming down, you were halfway through the production of the first film, I think, or three quarters. And then I came along and it was yourself and Tao, and I met you, Claire, and then I think you ran off set halfway through a shot. This is how busy, like both of you were. You were obviously always working.
Yeah.
But you'd come down, Matt had run in, off like, oh yeah, cool, they're just doing a shot there, and then I think I sat down and done a few lines a few times, and then Matt went, yeah, that was shit, so and I went, I think I've seen enough, that's what you said. He went, oh, I'm only joking. I was like, oh, fucking hell. Came down to your mess area, did a few lines, and just I think I had a little look at the set, which was impressive though, for you to kind of turn that warehouse into such. I think what was amazing is that you didn't make it look like we were reusing the same bits of tunnel. Yeah. Like it looks so different. Like you managed to get all the angles of it. So I saw that. I remember thinking, oh, it's pretty cool in there, man.
They look like mugs, but they're doing
all
right.
And I thought, it looks fucking pretty sick. I think you showed me one of the big set pieces. There's a big set piece which is quite key in sort of throughout the films. I saw that and I remember looking up at it thinking, bloody hell, that's impressive. Seen a lot of blood. And going, I want to be involved in this, but I'm a real wimp like when it comes to horror films, so
don't be like that.
The week before on this podcast when we just launched it, I was saying that I'd be wicked to get to be in a film, but I don't know how I'd be on a horror film set. I think I'd be scared, and that definitely was proven, because I think when we came onto set, because it was winter, so it was pretty dark outside when we were wrapping. Sometimes you'd be like the last person, or I might forget something, like a prop or something like that. Go back in the tunnel.
It was
so scary.
I remember going in the tunnel once before we even started shooting. It had just been built, and I was supposed to be meeting all the crew and Matt and everybody down in the tally in the tunnel. And I walked in, and there was no one there. It was like 7 a.m. or something.
Scary.
So I walked into the main tunnel just to have a look. Thought I'd have a look. Got halfway in, I was like, I need to get out.
Fuck that.
Because
this
is creepy.
Yeah,
and scary. You could hear the roof moving and creaking. Lucky I got a phone call, and I was like, I'm so glad you phoned.
It got crazy and creepy down there.
It was creepy.
Yeah.
It was. Mm. But it was a cool set though, man.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, it was just this tunnel system, obviously. But I remember, do you remember James, obviously?
Which James?
James Fishman. Fisher.
Yes. Yeah. James Coyne.
Yeah, James Coyne. I remember being
our second
he did everything. He was amazing.
He was hoovering the floor.
He was dual wielding Henry Hoover's to Hoover the warehouse for one of ones.
It's a warehouse. We're talking 174,000 feet of warehouse.
I remember being in the tunnels with him, and we're doing something like putting up some of the fake cabling and stuff like that, and it's pitch black. We've got like one torch, and we're larking about. We get summons. We start to walk out, and you walk past corners, and the corners were pretty scary because they're pitch black. You're like, I know there's a corner there. Flash the torch around. It goes from pitch black to a corner. You're like, what the fuck? And we were walking along those, and he said to me in that weird way that James says weird shit. And then again, he said, I'm going to get a werewolf costume and scare someone in here. I didn't know if he was joking or not. Who fucking knows? He was crazy. I was like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
No. Imagine that. Someone would actually shut the floor.
I'd shut myself many a time without any werewolf costume.
Yeah, I wouldn't need a werewolf costume.
Constantly shitting myself.
Are you sure you were making a film? Because that sounds familiar.
Method.
That sounds familiar.
Method, that is.
Proper method.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite, scene or moment from the film? Because we've been chatting shit about this all day. Like, we're talking.
I say one thing that stands out to me is there's a scene when I was eating.
Is that a spoiler?
No, scene when I was eating a biscuit. I say, well, that spoil it.
Biscuit
scenes. So I don't know what's happened to the biscuit scene. Is the biscuit scene still there?
Of course.
There's a biscuit scene, and I just remember I remember consuming the biscuits, and I think about 10 biscuits in, I was like, this is fucking great. Oh, 10 biscuits, yes. And then like 20 biscuits in, I was like, this is cool, but
dry.
Yeah, have a bit of water. 25 biscuits in, I think I was with Harriet, who's the main protagonist. Plays my sister in it. Like she just looked at me and she was like, "What's wrong?" I was like, "Too many biscuits." And she was like folding over laughing.
Too many biscuits. Too many biscuits.
Too many biscuits. So there's that, and there was also a scene with James Barnes, who is he's just the most militant man ever.
Are you talking about his sexy voice?
He has got a military vibe around him, hasn't he? He's very straight back, very serious, and he does play someone who's in the military. Then, and his voice is. It's just hot chocolate, isn't it? That's what his voice is. His voice is the hottest of hot chocolate.
Glad you said
he's got the smoothest voice out there. Yeah. And he had a line, which was, it was a very generic line. He had amazing lines, but it was literally a line like, let's go to the comms room, for example, like that. And he had to lean into
Lewis.
You're making me laugh.
Is it Lewis? Was it Michael? Lewis. Look,
and he's getting closer to the microphone.
Let's go to the comm room. But every time he said it, it just looked like he was saying, get back to my room. I'll see you at 6 o'clock in my room. Let's hit the showers. And I think everyone was folding up every single time. And it's a great scene. It was a really powerful scene. But I think those memories were great because I think what was good is there was a balance of fun that we had. Like, and it was quite, it was a cold warehouse. There were long days. I mean, you guys were there every single day. So, that was crazy.
Can't remember anymore.
But it was all right. You were whizzing around. So times like that stand out. I just had fun doing it. There's loads of fun. Yeah. Also seeing Matt eat three sticks of Twix at once in one go, putting them all in his mouth. Impressive feat.
Thank you.
I don't know where the fourth Twix went, but I remember you just shoving three in your mouth. Okay, cool. Yeah.
That's how I open my mouth so wide. First one goes in, locked jaw.
Loves a bit of chocolate.
Yeah. But how about you guys though? Like, what were scenes that stood out?
That's the thing that sticks in his head. It's me eating three Twixes.
It was the eye contact. That's what I remember. It was just the eye contact.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Never break eye contact. Once a third Twix goes in, you know you're gone.
And the big swallow.
The big goes down like a cartoon fish head. Like a cat's
I had loads of fun, man. It was wicked. It was great. I think there was a scene where I was trying to be scared under a bed, and you said that the angle that I was, it looked like I was just laughing all the time. I
remember that's that, a great scene.
Beautiful.
That's great.
How about you guys? I know there's like loads of amazing scenes of me in it, but what kind of scenes stood out to you? Because there's some quite, you do some quite cool things with the camera, like you have some quite interesting rigging and setups that you use, so there might be scenes that
ingenuity.
Yeah,
one of my favourite scenes, actually, talking as it is edited now, is one of yours. in the wheelchair, the 1950 wheelchair that was a real 1950s wheelchair, by the way.
Yeah, we have to talk about the props as well. There was some real creepy but real shit in there. Yeah. But yeah, sorry. So you're saying, Claire?
So the favorite, one of my favorite scenes is your one when you're in the wheelchair and they all walk off and leave you. If you can remember that, you probably can't remember.
Fucking scary. Now I remember because it was the closest I got to being left in the tunnel with everyone in the room, and that it was pretty scary. That was fun. Yeah,
there is some great scenes.
Yeah, there's loads. I mean, there's an element, because it's a very scary film, but you managed to throw in elements of comedy as well. Yeah, which kind of gives us a nice up and down journey. Yeah, from what I've seen. I don't know, I've not seen this edit, this recent cut. What about you, Matt, though?
I think it's got blank faced. What part of MK Ultra are we talking about? They could. It's a tough one, you know, because like I said, trigger warning. I think we were chatting about this earlier, me and Claire, and one of my favorite scenes to shoot was a damage control scene, because we had like this, you know, extravagant fight scene. I thought actually it's the one where you get grabbed.
Oh shit! No, that was. But there's a few intense fight scenes. So
Sorry,
one of the bigger scenes, you say?
One of the bigger scenes, and we with this sort of extravagant fight scene, and was going to happen over like on the page and in the film, it would have taken around about maybe three days, the way we were shooting it, like super fast, cutting corners, like indie filmmakers. If you're doing it on a normal film set, you're talking about a couple of weeks, but we could have got through it in a couple of days, maybe 3 days, but we didn't have them, full stop. So we only had an afternoon, I think, or morning, one of the two. It was half a day basically.
After morning.
And we instead of shooting it normally, we got our poor DOP Jamie Burr, who's amazing, to rig up all the lights so they'd be out of shot, and then we did it all on a GoPro, and we rehearsed all the fight and all the action as you remember, Marcus, and we did it all on a GoPro, and we took our lead lady.
Yeah, that was funny.
Our lead lady, Harriet, and Adelaide, who's incredible in this very, very serious role, this incredible actress, serious role, beautiful, and amazing, and intense as well. And then we stuck a cricket helmet on her that we got from a discount.
Was it like red
store
as well? Was it it was a blue
cricket helmet.
It was a bright colour though.
And then we gaffer taped a GoPro to the front, and then she had to start scene laying on her side, and then she had a gun in it. She had fucking gun in someone's face, and it was fucking brilliant.
That's one of my favourite scenes as well.
I love watching that scene.
Really
so
well.
Much fun. Yeah, it was really funny.
You all nailed it. Well done.
Yeah, she was the camera woman. She was she was everything. It was great.
That was awesome. Yeah, I remember seeing a bit of that. And like Claire, like you kind of hit upon the actual real 1950s chairs and stuff like that. There were loads of props in that. That's another thing that was creepy. Like, you actually had loads of real props in the room. So when they were dressed, when the cameras weren't rolling, or if we got in just before, or if you're standing in another area because you're getting some clean cuts or whatever, we'd be in a room which was literally like you're in the 50s.
Yeah,
do you know
amazing.
What I mean? Like,
we had amazing set designers, actually.
Yeah, how the hell do you get so much? I didn't even know that this stuff, I thought this stuff would all be in a bin or in like somewhere missing.
There was.
Was it really hard to get your hands on this sort
no,
of stuff?
No, I mean,
we collected half of it. Didn't we?
Yeah, some was collected, but most of the hard stuff we had to find was we'd just shot a film before, and we needed a deactivated shotgun, and I had about an hour to find a gun.
I thought he was going
to
say, and I had about six at home.
So I just
deactivated one, and I just deactivated one of my shotguns and put it in.
Right now,
for fuck's sake, it's a whole shotgun. Yeah, go on.
So we found this shotgun, but the place we found it in was an amazing kind of museum, and it really wasn't a museum. It was a
collection.
Yeah, a collection of real war, like tanks and everything this guy had in about three massive warehouses. And we were like, oh, we're shooting the Risen soon. Can we stay in contact and we can use some of these props? So basically, when we were ready to go, we gave him a call and he came down and he had real stuff. That was a real 1950s wheelchair. That was their real ammunition cases. Guns, crazy.
Yeah, guns are 303s everything.
Yeah, Combatant Combat, I think they were called. Combatant Combat. Amazing place.
And you did that in real where you could. So, you know, we went to like the least secret bunker. So I just I love the fact that when we're going driving to this secret bunker, you see a sign that said secret bunker, quarter of a mile. I'd be like, okay, cool. So you actually, where you could, like, you added in as much realism as possible, which is, I think it's quite a privilege in 2000 and whatever it was, a few years ago, to kind of be able to go to places where things like this, because that was another place that kind of a lot of the props that they had there, because that was a museum, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we originally were going to try and shoot there.
Yeah, the whole thing.
But I think our problem was that because it was a nuclear bunker, and we were going to try and shoot there, but our main problem was that over the years it was built in the like 50s, but when it was covered in 80s stuff, like it was the wrong era, and in order to shoot there we'd have to literally gut it.
Our real problem that was a problem, but our main problem was we didn't have the money for that. It was way too expensive to shoot there permanently.
But it was a
Kelvin Hatch.
Kelvin Hatch. It's a great place.
Great pies in the canteen as well. Food was all right, wasn't it? That was cool too.
Remember the buckshot?
Yeah, that was James.
Oh, that was it. Yeah, a bit James of buckshot.
James Coyne. He was like, "Yeah, I'll have a pheasant pie or something."
Yeah.
And they were fresh.
Yeah, too fucking right,
because they had buckshot in them.
Yeah, that's the kind of pie.
He turned vegetarian after that.
Funny,
did he?
Yeah, he was vegetarian.
Not does he not at least eat fish? Because
fish
by name. So what do you think, I'm going to ask both of you one by one so you can answer when you want, one of the most challenging shots or parts of production are, because you know it's no small feat kind of getting a UK production out of there, two back-to-back films, and using your resources as smartly as possible. So like, what are one of the biggest challenges? Well, that's fucking hard.
Dead air. I mean, dragging any independent film over the finish line is a feat. Like dragging.
I think that would be my biggest challenge.
If we're talking about specific, like difficult moments, though. They all blur into one.
it was quite a difficult. The two films were quite difficult to shoot. We had some financial problems all the way through, which were out of our control, unfortunately. So it was all, particularly on the second film, Risen Possession. Although it's looking great and we're very proud of what we've done, it was a very hard shoot to do. So for me, it just blurs into a big trigger warning. But
Trigger warning.
And I was trying to defend you a little bit from it, so you didn't know quite what was going on.
Yeah.
So you're probably better answering that question.
Oh, gutted. Don't take that. There you go.
On set. What was your toughest thing on set?
Because he had some tough shots, and like you had no time to pull them off.
Yeah, I think the it's a weird thing because you're so privileged to actually make a film that you feel like if anything's difficult, then it's. I mean, not only that is you're in this weird privileged position of making the film, but also you've written the film, and so it's all your fucking fault. who are you going to blame, dickhead? Like, you wanted five people running down the down the thing, and then you cut to this, and then this guy's with gun. Like, you wanted that. What are you going to complain about now? There's a little bit of that going on. So anything that was difficult, it was a case of how can we make this not look how it's supposed to look, but look how we'd be happy with it looking. Like, how can we make this as best as it possibly can be? And some of those things are like you take those two or three pages, those two or three days of fight scene, and you go, we've only got an afternoon or a morning afternoon to do it, and we do it on a GoPro. And then some of the things are you have to figure out that you have to run down behind someone with a crash mat, and that's how they fall on it. And,
yeah.
You know, so it's, they really do blur into one. I don't think there was anything that was an easy day. There's nothing where you're like, oh, that was a nice one. You sit back and crack your knuckles, and then you go to lunch. And
no
then
time
the next
for that.
It's a hard one. Like, you
no
like,
time for that.
That wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was every morning was working out what we're going to cut, where we're going to move it to, like, how fucked are we? How are we going to do this? How are we going to pull this off?
Yeah.
And you had like scenes where you knew that was coming, though. That's so you had like you knew that the we were going to have to spend a day and a half doing this particular fight scene, but we only had half a day or a day, so you knew those days were coming. So,
but that is independent filmmaking, though. That's definitely. Like big lovely studio filmmaking. That's independent filmmaking.
Yeah. Would you guys fancy a bit of that though in the future? Because I've read a bit about filmmaking recently, just as part of a story, and a big thing was about how some filmmakers really thrive whilst they're in situations like this, and there's been some filmmakers when they get given carte blanche, it just fucks up the total flow of what they put out. So I know as people that, you know, you said that it was a tight run, this, you know, how would you feel working with like one of the big boys, big people?
Yeah, I'm for it.
Because
I think
how would your content change? Maybe do you think you'd do something different, or is there a project that you've got ready in the wings that is kind of just needs that big sign?
It's a tough one. I don't know. I mean, I think that's what we're trying to get to. Is we're trying to produce work that we're happy with, and we have very high standards for ourselves.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's really where we're trying to get to.
Yeah.
And also, we've not been through that particular meat grinder. The meat grinder we have been through is indie filmmaking.
Yeah.
So we know where the punches are coming from.
Yeah.
For that, and I think sometimes I suppose if you don't know where the punches are coming from, but you feel like you should be in control of everything because you've been given, you know, carte blanche with a blank check, then that must fuck with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Same. It's,
so like how
it's weird.
So like we talk a lot on the show about like how Netflix and Amazon Prime is kind of changing the way we consume films. So for indie filmmakers, how do these platforms work with the kind of content that you produce?
So I don't really understand the question.
So like with the film that you're making, how do platforms like Netflix then be available, and Amazon Prime, is that something that you're like, I can take advantage of that? That's the place I'd really want to sit on first, or are there other avenues or places that you want to put your films first? Because I think that's quite interesting for indie films. A lot of people don't know how they get where they get to, and how you feel about Netflix and how you feel about Amazon Prime.
Oh, you love having your film on Netflix or Amazon. Yeah, definitely, for sure. Yeah. Or Sky. We've got one on Sky at the moment. We're very happy to have it there.
What was that? Let's give it a plug.
That's The Gatehouse. So that's the film.
Oh, fucking hell. That's a scary one, isn't it?
No, it's a kid's film.
Oh, is it? Is it?
It doesn't sound like a kid's film.
So we literally wrapped that and then went straight into Risen's. Yeah, it's great. I love it. I love the fact that these streaming networks have now opened up, and it really helps independent filmmakers. As long as you got to have contacts in there. That's the thing. Or you got to like sign it to the right sales agent, and just obviously as an independent filmmaker, be careful what sales agents you're signing to. Just read up a little bit. But yeah, great. I'm loving it. I'm loving Netflix, and it opens up these tiny films to a wider audience. Netflix and Amazon Prime and so yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So
it was a really boring answer.
Yeah, that's all right. Listen, a lot of people.
It's like it's been one of those days.
A lot of people ask me stuff like that, so it's good to. I can't answer that, so it's good that you can. But what are you guys like consuming at the moment? Because you churn. I mean, I see you as like sci-fi and horror specialist. Like, is that what you watch? Like when you're on Netflix and you're watching TV, what do you watch?
I love
Playdays, Teletubbies.
Matt watches porn. We all know that.
Yeah, I'm watching porn right now.
Porn Teletubbies.
Porn Teletubbies. Yeah. SpongeBob SquarePants comes off real bad. In that one, to be honest. Yeah, for reasons.
His pants ain't square, so it's not even the square.
This is gross.
Yeah, I love sci-fi. That's I'm not really a massive horror fan, having made horror films, but I love sci-fi. I love true story. I watch anything as long as it's good. It's all right.
I'm
sci-fi horror or horror sci-fi, fucking anything. Yeah. Look, as long as it's a good fun story, I'll usually go on recommendations.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like, see if you. I mean, a lot of my friends A lot of my close friends are like horror fans anyway. Like they'll be in like Jess, for example, a friend who did the makeup on the Risen's, Jess Heath.
Yes.
Like she's a horror genius. And so she'll be like, she'll WhatsApp me something to watch. She'll be like, that's what I got to watch now. Yeah. Like, you know, and she's invariably right. It's amazing. So I'll do that. What I don't tend to do anymore is go for like the cheapest sci-fi horror I can find. Like I went through a stage of being like, this is probably the worst film ever made, I'm gonna watch it. Like I used to do that. I did that a lot. Like, yeah. And then I worked my way out of those, and now I'm on to normal stuff.
Graduated to normal stuff.
They're hilarious. They're great. People did that to us.
No. They probably do. Yeah, this looks rubbish.
This is bollocks. What a wanker.
Actually, it was fairly good.
Actually, a bit high in that.
Yeah, I've been doing a bit of Star Trek recently, actually.
I've been going from the original series.
So I watched all of that.
Wow.
No, the original series. Oh, so I watched all of that. Watched the animated series, which not many people know exists.
I didn't even know about that.
It's got William Shatner and everyone else like in an animated series. So it's like a bit of what they couldn't show because they didn't have the tech to.
That's amazing.
So it kind of leads on, some of the stuff you see in it is very TNG, because
that's cool.
The next generation, because they, with cartoons you can do it, can't you? Can have like a flying monster with 17 arms, whatever.
Don't give Matt ideas for that
right.
In a new film.
That sounds all right.
But that's the great name for a film, flying monster with 17 arms.
Notepad or something. But I'll forget it in a second.
Forget what?
What?
And I just finished TNG last night. I almost shed a tear.
Almost? Every episode of TNG. How dare you?
Wow.
Almost? You use a hot made coal?
What? I don't know.
Describe that last episode. What was the part that made
it was,
you well up?
It's like a 90-minute special.
Yeah.
And it's the poker game.
Yes.
Oh, it's All Good Things. That's what it's called. So there's a poker game, and there's some very choice words said by Picard and the rest of the, I think, the seven main people that you see.
All her clothes are off.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. And yeah, it's just like, I don't want to spoil it, because I really think people should go and check out TNG, because I think that's the Star Trek that was really wanted by the production team, but they just couldn't do it back then. Rodders wanted that from a Star Trek.
It feels like that's the one everyone gravitates towards. That feels like the one.
Yeah.
And that's the most, almost the most heart in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel definitely. Like Voyager's like I'll watch Voyager and I love it, but you don't like Voyager.
That's next on the menu. I've got Deep Space Nine next. I've got film. I think I've got Generations. Deep Space Nine to watch. So that's what I'm going to geek out on.
I'm with some proper geeks.
Yeah, man.
What are you talking about? We're cool. Yeah. This is what coolness looks like. That's what coolness looks like.
Give me a coolness.
This is what being a weirdo looks like, but that's cool.
So, when's the Risen Possession out?
So that's up to our sales agent. It'll be this year.
All right. But if we wanted to get a little sneaky peeky preview of it, I think we can. Yes. Can we have this month, next month?
Premiere, 22nd of May, I think 8:30 Sci-Fi Film Festival. We are closing the whole festival. So
second year in a row.
We've been invited.
Sci-Fi London Film Festival.
Yeah.
Sci-Fi London.
Is that going to be over Stratford Way again?
Yes.
Is it last year?
Stratford Picture House.
That's it.
If you visit Lost Life Films, you'll see little links on our websites, on Instagram or Twitter.
Cool.
Get some tickets and see Marcus, the wonderful Marcus,
eating a biscuit.
Yeah,
eating the shit out of a biscuit. Yeah. I've never seen a biscuit getting eaten like the way I ate that fucking biscuit. To hell. You watch that and you'll be like, I want to be one of those biscuits.
He's great at hiding under beds.
Yeah,
you can do that.
It's in my CV now. What do you do in your spare time? Hide under beds, eat biscuits.
Eat plenty of biscuits.
Is that a Twix?
Yeah, a bit of a dicky question this, but like, what else is coming up now? Because I feel like you're like doing this, but you're really active though, aren't you?
Well, there we are.
I was getting out of breath in the lift. I'm glad there's no stairs.
Yeah. We are so happy to hand over the Risen in the Risen Possession. It's amazing. We've got about 16 projects in development at the moment, which is very cool.
16? Jesus.
Yeah, all at different stages. Some true stories, TV series, films. It's all very exciting. We're hopefully about to sign quite a very exciting deal with a huge studio, Touchwood.
Onward, sorry. Yeah.
yeah, so we can't say too much at the moment because I don't want to flummox it all.
Oh no, don't flummox us. Yeah, we tried to steer towards some episodic content,
yeah.
So towards like TV star content. So that was where we went while we were finishing The Risen 2 yes. up. We tried to kind of think, okay, what's next for us while we're doing this? What's the next thing that we can start to push towards? And that was episodic content. So
yeah,
nice.
A couple of series essentially.
Mm-hmm. Binge worthy content.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty Proper. Funny. And not straight horror either.
No. Yeah.
Sci-fi though. Yeah.
No.
What?
Like,
what?
Say what?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Go on, give us a little taster, like at least the genre.
We got some comedy, just straight comedy, drama. We've got some true life drama. We have some...
We've got plenty of true life drama.
Yeah.
Matt with a GoPro and a cricket helmet walking around.
True life drama, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got some speculative fiction.
Speculative fiction, yes.
Yeah. It's some lovely films. Actually, Matt's writing a film at the moment.
Don't drag me into this.
And some great stuff. Some great stuff coming up. Very exciting.
Okay. Should be the title. Very Don't exciting. Drag me into this.
Yeah.
Name your sex tape.
Yes.
Before I let you go, a couple of things. Like, how the fuck do you write a film? Like, do you know what I mean? I'm just like,
oh no,
I don't know.
How does that happen? Does he just, you lock him in a room? He comes out a few weeks later with the scribbles on paper.
I wish it was a few weeks. It takes a long time.
Slow rubbish. I'm sorry. What do you do? The process for us tends to be we chat a right load of old shit about what we want to do, and then we come up with a few ideas of what we want to do, and then lock me away with it, and then we usually have something that's it's kind of like a synopsis-y sort of something that represents the tone of what we want to do.
We chat about it for a bit, and then
the physical writing of it, I'll usually go through a process of I'll write 1 to 90 down a page, and then just write a word or a sentence for every minute of the film, and that gives me a roadmap for the film.
Sure.
You can start that anywhere. You can start it at the end, like big explosion, everyone, you know, turns to dust or something.
Spoiled the whole film. There you go. Spoiled the whole Risen Possession. Fuck's sake, man. Come on.
Just fill those in, and then from there you can start the script, and it'll usually move around, but that's the very boring answer of how you write script.
And it's so hard to find good writers. So hard. It's not boring. It's so hard to find good writers. It really is. Go through. I mean, as I said, we got 16 productions in development. Three of those, I think, are from you and the wonderful Vicky Sargent. But the others are all we would spend time finding the right story or the right book and optioning them and finding other writers to adapt them. And
yeah,
it's hard.
What makes a good writer then?
Really difficult.
They're just not shit. Yeah.
That's a good
you know
a
shit,
that's a
you
good
know a shit writer.
That's a good,
not that.
That
kind of not, not a shit one, Marcus.
Yeah, not shit one. Yeah, yeah, not shit. Yeah.
Good version, isn't it?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's talent. It's pure talent. It really is. I mean, I can't write.
Yeah, neither can I. Write, yeah. I could just about read. So
yeah, same. Same. I don't know. It's talent, and Matt's probably one of the best writers I know.
She needs to get out more.
I've enjoyed having your words in my mouth and my head, Matt.
You are making my Twix go to an extra large. It's not really. My Twix is never extra large. You know that.
All right. Well, thanks for coming.
Why is he laughing?
This is not true. I promise. Yeah, no, thanks for coming down to How to Kill an Hour, though, and The Risen Possession and The Risen, like, both great films. Well, I've seen The Risen. I've not seen the latest cut of The Risen Possession, so you can find all 2 minutes of me in it, because the rest of it's on the cutting room floor. But, like, honestly, wish you all the best of it, man, and
thank
I look forward to seeing it at the screening.
Thank you.
Seeing what Lost Eye turns out in the future, man.
Thank you.
Cheers. This has been How to Kill an Hour. Thank you for killing some time with us. I will be in your ear holes very soon.
You can vote for us in the Listener's Choice Awards at this year's British Podcast Awards 2019. If you'd like to vote for us, it only takes a minute of your time. Head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. That's britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Type in How to Kill an Hour, and then, yeah, you'll have voted for us. It only takes a minute of your time, and we'd really appreciate it. We'll also put a link in the show's description. Thank you very much in advance. And hey, here's hoping we win.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.